and welcome to One-on-One with LAPA, the Legislative Analysis and Public Policy Association's podcast series, where experts discuss key issues and emerging topics in the areas of public health and safety, substance use disorders, and the criminal justice system. LAPA is funded by a grant from the Office of National Drug Control Policy, Executive Office of the President. Neither the Office of National Drug Control Policy nor any other federal instrumentality operate, control, are responsible for, or necessarily endorse this podcast. I am Heather Gray, Senior Legislative Attorney with LAPA, your host for today's podcast on recovery-ready workplace programs, which are programs designed to work with employers to adopt policies and procedures that assist employees with substance use disorder. They are also known as recovery-friendly workplace programs. My guest today is Samantha Lewandowski, the Program Director for the New Hampshire Governor's Recovery-Friendly Workplace Initiative. Hello and welcome, Ms. Lewandowski. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you to you and LAPA. I've so enjoyed our collaboration thus far, and I'm really excited to be here today.
Thank you. So can you start by telling our listeners a little bit about the New Hampshire Governor's Recovery-Friendly Workplace Initiative and your role within that program?
Yes, definitely. So like you mentioned, Recovery-Friendly Workplace in New Hampshire is an initiative of Governor Sununu. He launched the initiative in March of 2018, and we have seen a lot of growth since that time. We started with around 25 early adopter workplaces, and we now have over 350 participating workplaces representing over 95,000 employees. So I like to say, you know, we got something right. And we are administered by Granite United Way, which is a really respected and trusted community partner that does a lot of work around public health, emergency preparedness, in addition to a lot of other community work. And so I think we have a really good blend of kind of that statewide support and visibility with some of that nonprofit agility and community connection. I also think a big part of the initiative's success is the governor's background as a former CEO and business person himself. So I feel like we were really able to marry public health best practice with that business insight to really make something that worked for the business community when it comes to really helping them develop those cultures around advancing wellness and supporting behavioral health recovery in the workplace with that focus on substance use disorder. Although we do also include mental health approaches to the extent that the business would like to incorporate those. And a little bit more about me. So I started in January of 2019, I believe it was, actually in our staff position, which is that of a recovery-friendly advisor. So our recovery-friendly advisors, who you might hear me refer to as RFAs, are working one-on-one with each workplace, going through a checklist of items with them that each workplace needs to do to achieve that recovery-friendly designation. And that's really around developing that recovery-friendly culture. And then I became the initiative's assistant director, and now I am the program director. So I'm responsible for overseeing staff and subcontractors, making sure that our strategy and processes are really sound. I've also done some work in the national space because what we found was we had a lot of other states reaching out to us, wanting to learn more, wanting to replicate the initiative. And we are very fortunate that we have the governor's support and Granite United Way's support in supporting those other states. And as those efforts grew, we decided to launch a national multi-state community of practice to give all those folks who are working on implementing a space to gather, brainstorm around shared challenges, share best practices. So we have, I think, over 30 states represented in that now, spanning over 55 entities. So that's been really incredible. And in terms of myself, I'm a loved one and an ally of people in recovery. I first started my work in this space in a harm reduction program in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I bring kind of a sociological community development research perspective to this work, and I'm just really grateful for the opportunity and my evolution in this role. It's been really fun.
Oh, that's fantastic. You guys are doing a lot of really good work in New Hampshire. And anytime I talk to anyone in the RFW field, they always say, have you talked to Sam?
Thank you. That's so sweet.
So you mentioned recovery friendly advisor, workplace advisors, and as part of I'm going to refer to them as RFW or RRW programs, recovery ready workplace programs. What are some of the key components of those programs, you know, in addition to providing advisors and resources and that sort of thing? What is a recovery ready workplace program, and what are some of the key components of a successful program?
Yeah, that's a great question. And sometimes I think of it as one of our kind of million-dollar questions. And I think what's interesting in New Hampshire is that if someone asked us to define it, we really go back to our checklist, just because those are the items we are asking every workplace to do. So from kind of a nuts and bolts perspective, what we're looking for workplaces to do is sign up with us, get connected to that recovery-friendly advisor who walks them through the process, do a declaration letting their employees know, hey, we're participating. We ask for them to do things like disseminate information and resources, do some kind of annual training in the year, get connected to their local recovery community organization, review any policies and procedures that they might have in light of a recovery-friendly lens. And then optional components include things like doing a community event or developing like an RFW committee. And so those are kind of some of the items. But beyond that, what we're looking for at a recovery-friendly workplace, I think, really is the presence of psychological safety. And so do employees know that they're a recovery-friendly workplace? And we've heard that, and we know from research that people really need to message and message again. People really need to hear it multiple times that you're doing this work. We want to make sure that employees know their rights and the procedures and policies around coming forward so that they are empowered to make the best choice for them. We want managers to be trained and having them adopt a supportive approach. So if C-level is on board, but it doesn't really trickle down to kind of those middle managers, then that support might not be getting out as well. We would like for employees to know about resources within the workplace, but also outside of the workplace. So kind of having that level set on education, that's a lot of what we do, is connecting people to resources and educating people on resources. And I'm trying to think if I'm missing any components. I think really psychological safety is big. You know, we tell people like part of a recovery-friendly workplace, or one of the biggest parts, is knowing that it's okay to be a human and be going through human things. So I think in that maybe a little bit more of an old school mentality, it was like, you don't talk about it, you suck it up, buttercup. And we now know through more of a trauma-informed lens that those issues don't really go anywhere. And in fact, when you closet people, it's probably affecting their performance oftentimes. And so with a recovery-friendly approach, it's creating that space to express that and get support, and then in turn, oftentimes see better outcomes at work. So we know from research from National Safety Council and a couple of other sources that people in recovery save companies money, and around certain metrics are actually outperforming the general workforce. So I hope I didn't miss anything there, but yeah, definitely that safety and coming forward if you need help. And again, knowing your rights so that you can make the best decision around where you access that support. And I guess one other thing, just to take it a step further, is seeing people in recovery not just as something you're kind of giving or doing for them, but really seeing them as an asset and a strength. And we talk about in the initiative being open to hiring really whoever's the best for the job. So we don't mandate who people hire, but being open to the best candidate, including if that person is in recovery.
So in addition to making sure that they're aware of the resources and things, do you encourage employers to get employees involved in the process of becoming recovery friendly?
Yeah, I think that that's something we continue to think through, because we really do work a lot with management, HR, C-level. We definitely do manager-focused trainings, but I think one direction we're interested in the future is, can we maybe do some evaluation where we get employee perspectives and really see how maybe it's trickling down to reach them? And so we're actually doing a process improvement scope of work right now where we are thinking through all these things. We've actually done a really nice survey and evaluation of the program, and we kind of want to take it to that next step. I think the first phase of the initiative was really getting it off the ground and giving it a little bit of time so we had a program to evaluate and see how it was going. But we definitely have anecdotes and definitely feedback from HR and management around the efficacy of the program and outcomes that they're seeing. And I think one thing I really enjoy, kind of on a more story-based level, is when my staff are going out and doing trainings, we do often have employees coming up to us and speaking to the impact of this approach. So as we move forward, just looking to capture that maybe a little bit more systematically. And I think another place where employees can really get involved is when employers do choose to create that RFW committee, which we've definitely seen. So in those committees, we really encourage diverse representation and making sure to get different positions. Like, you definitely want employee and staff representation there.
Excellent. Thank you. Can you talk about some of the common issues that programs face and some ways in which to overcome or address those issues?
Yeah, so I think that in New Hampshire, we were really fortunate to launch with governor support. I've seen in other states, sometimes it takes off that way and sometimes it doesn't. And I think that when it's less of that top-down support, people are left with maybe a little bit more of a regionalized model where they are doing a pilot. And then the question that kind of comes out of that is, how do we sustain that and scale it for our state? So these are questions we are continuing to grapple with those other partners in other states. And, you know, I know that we've done, not me personally, but some of my colleagues have done landscape analyses of RFW initiatives across the country. NIEHS has one. My colleague Allison Weingarten and Jonathan Rosen led that work. And then my colleague, Dr. John Narine, who's based out of Colorado, did another analysis around that. And one of the biggest things they found is just that need for funding. You know, people are wondering, where do I get funding to do this work? I think that one thing that helped make New Hampshire so successful was that dedicated staffing. So When we launched, we didn't have any dedicated staff, and our public health networks took the work on, which was really helpful, but we really needed dedicated staff. So we got that on board. But when they don't have that, there's a lot that needs to be done in terms of branding, developing assets, you know, training content, and then really working with businesses. So we have found, at least for us, that businesses have not adopted as much of a self-serve model around this work. So toolkits can be very helpful for accumulating research and compiling best practices and really having a foundation to build from. But we found that that one-on-one advisor relationship is critical. So really getting funding and support. And then another thing that we hear a call for is more research and evaluation around RFW programs and assessing their efficacy. And I do like to point out, I like to be asset-based. So I do really try to point to National Safety Council's excellent work. And, you know, we've done a survey that I think was pretty cool, albeit exploratory. So I think that there is a need, but also recognizing the assets that people have to draw upon. I'm trying to think of other challenges. You know, business engagement. I think businesses care about this work, and a lot of people are motivated beyond the bottom line, which I think is surprising for people to learn, but they do have capacity constraints. So when it comes to RFW, it is an investment. You know, your culture doesn't transform magically. So there is a certain level of buy-in, but in New Hampshire, we really try to customize to a business's level of capacity and readiness and to really work with them. And I think that the more this work might be able to be paired with workforce development efforts, which some states are doing, and we are working on expanding into that arena even more. But I think the more we can kind of help businesses find people, that furthers the value add, and kind of, because they need that capacity, that could help lessen the lift for them. And kind of, I know New York, my colleague Ken Daly, who's the executive director of the Gino Macchio Foundation, they do a really nice job pairing placing people with saying, well, place people, but you need to be a recovery-friendly workplace. So along with some of these challenges, really a lot of innovative solutions out there, which is why I love the community of practice, so we can kind of learn and brainstorm. And then, yeah, just appreciating the toolkits that exist that compile that research. I think that there is a need for more, just more support around the question of how do we get this started? What do we do in our state? What are the funding sources? I think New Hampshire can provide a lot of information around what we've done, but every state is really unique. Yeah, so I think I'll just end with saying that I think there is a need to build off of the TA that New Hampshire has provided and really see what other kinds of assets can be compiled for other states who are looking for support. And along with that, I think the other population that we could serve even more is really large national complex workplaces. I think that an RFW model for those businesses might look a little different. So I think more research is needed there. And I think that sums up some of the major things that I'm seeing.
So you mentioned buy-in and getting buy-in from employers. So what do you think are some of the best ways to get employers to buy into these programs and get their engagement and involvement?
So I think that it's important to assess a business's level of readiness and kind of where they're at on the continuum of culture change. So one thing I'll speak to is when doing RFW work, it's kind of like you want to embrace the Hippocratic Oath in a way. So first, do no harm. So we don't want to force a workplace to sign up who really maybe isn't truly ready, because saying that it's a safe space for people to come forward and then not having it be can actually do more damage. So really seeing where a workplace is and making sure that it's a good fit for the program. And maybe if it's not, can we do an introductory meeting, give resources, kind of plant the seed, and then see if they'll be ready to sign on later, which we do see that trajectory. I think another thing that we try to do is shift this perception of substance use disorder as something that's out there that businesses will be inviting into the workplace, and try to really frame it as it's already happening. So we know about 10% of the population has a substance use disorder. There's another study that talks about 9% of people being in recovery, kind of defining recovery as identifying past year substance use and that they're no longer using. We know that around 1 in 2 people are indirectly impacted. We know about, you know, mental health impact and how that increased even further with COVID. And so I think just letting employers know that this is really a way to build in support and proactively address these issues rather than having them catch you off guard. So, you know, we've heard about workplaces that have had overdoses and then get connected to us afterwards. And conversely, workplaces that connect with us. One of my favorite stories with RFW is a workplace that did a Narcan training with us, got Narcan on site because we do distribute and connect workplaces to Narcan, and was actually able to save a life because they had gone through that with us. So that's the kind of thing we're talking about. Also being able to have that branding, you know, similar to like a veteran-owned business, you know, that means something in terms of social responsibility. It means something to your workforce, your current workforce. It can be used to attract employees. We've heard of employees knowing that workplaces are recovery-friendly and wanting to work there, and signifying to a customer base, and customers care about that. And we've heard about that. We do have people who come to us multiple times saying, I would love a list of your recovery-friendly workplaces. So that's part of kind of the package of signing on, is that workplaces are showcased. You know, they're showcased on social media. They get to use our logo. They're on our website. And we know that people in recovery are going to our website to look at those employers, as are our partners. And again, just, you know, the National Safety Council research, we know it saves money. We know that the cost of unaddressed and unsupported SUD in the workplace is great. So it stands to reason that by supporting that, we're going to see those savings. And we know that workers in recovery, you know, often are making very loyal employees. They're very grateful for the opportunity that they're being given. The only thing I'll say around that is I think we need to embrace that and appreciate that. without also expecting more from people in recovery. Like, I think appreciating that they deliver that, but it can almost kind of get into that realm of stigma, you know, like you have this thing, so you need to overcompensate for it. So what I really encourage with recovery in this space is looking at it with parity to another health condition. So we wouldn't expect that from somebody with cancer. You know, we wouldn't expect them necessarily to come back and over deliver. So I think, again, appreciating that and appreciating those assets without having that kind of become our norm or baseline that we expect a way over performance to kind of overcompensate for the stigma and the shame that can be unfairly placed upon those in recovery.
You also mentioned earlier, you talked about some of the resources that are available for states and organizations looking to start a recovery-ready workplace program and trainings available for employers. Can you talk a little bit more about those?
Yeah, and I wish I could speak to this even further. I think I'm still working on wrapping my mind around the landscape in each state, and I think that that's why dedicated resources and capacity will be able to do even more there. I know that one entity I partnered with was the Opioid Response Network, and they provide TA to states who are looking to do a variety of work in this space. What's a little bit funny is sometimes they'll get connected to me again, and we've partnered before, but it's been really great because they've provided, you know, structure, meeting agendas, coordinating things, keeping people on task, setting goals. So that's a really great resource. You know, we will talk about, you know, opioid abatement settlement funds, encouraging people to look into that. We've talked about SOAR funds, which stands for, I believe, State Opioid Response. We can definitely educate people on our funding streams. And I know I really appreciate the work that LAPA is doing around model legislation, because I think that that's definitely a tool and a resource that can be leveraged by other states, kind of looking at what are core components of a recovery-friendly model based on best practices and evidence, what might funding look like, how might people get this passed via legislation to kind of build in some of that sustainability. I mean, I would say that the community of practice is definitely a resource for networking and things like that. We've also created a community platform to go around with that that gives, I call them implementers, so other states who are doing this work, I call them implementers. And so that gives them access to a platform where they can have dialogue with one another and share resources. So I think that that's been really great. But yeah, overall, just hoping to see even more TA and assets and support in this workplace. I know that ONDCP will be launching a toolkit that's mentioned on their Recovery Resource Hub. ONDCP stands for Office of National Drug Control Policy. I think that that toolkit will be great because, you know, compiling that research can be really cumbersome, and people do like stats and data, especially programs wanting to make sure that they're built on that foundation. So that will take the lift off of states in that regard. And then, you know, we can share a lot of our tools and trainings and materials. So we just have a fidelity checklist that we need to make sure people follow to show fidelity to our model. And if people do, we can even share our brand with them. So the goal there from the governor was really like, he'll say, copy paste, you know, let's not reinvent the wheel. With that being said, we also understand that states do tend to like to customize to a degree. So we work to support that. But yeah, there definitely are assets out there for people to leverage. And I also think we can build upon that foundation.
Wonderful. You mentioned the community of practice. And so is that only available to state programs? Or if someone were interested in, like, if they're, you know, it's a private organization looking to start a program within a state, can they join the community of practice? And if so, how would they do that? Just get in touch with you or some other method?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would say that our community of practice has really focused on supporting governmental entities and nonprofit organizations. The reason being is that in order to use our model, one of our stipulations is that it needs to remain available at no cost. So I would say it's really a case-by-case basis. So if a private entity comes to us and they are planning not to charge for their recovery-friendly materials, it can definitely be a conversation. We just really want to make sure that it's a best fit for our community or Is there another place that they could be supported in this work? But we do have a lot of information and materials on our website that people can reference. And again, there's some great toolkits and resource hubs out there, and we are happy to point people in that direction as well.
So with your community practice, I think you mentioned you had 30 states involved in that.
Yeah, we should have actually over 30 states represented now. And there's a map floating around out there, and we're very proud of the map. It shows the representation across the nation. I think with more capacity, we could try to identify contacts in other states who we don't yet have. We've only done that a time or two, and really it's been a lot of people seeking us out, which is incredible. It's a really amazing community. I don't think I've ever seen like a meeting where people are so genuinely enthusiastic to show up. So this map, people get really excited, and sometimes they'll go, these are all the states that have recovery-friendly workplace initiatives. And I'll say, I really wish. It is a really positive metric. It's actually all of the states that have representation at the community of practice. So they might have initiatives started, they might not yet. And in the future, we're looking at how to adapt that map to, right now there's it's a PDF, there's hyperlinks, people can click on them to kind of see what's going on in the states. But we want to change that a little bit to accommodate kind of the growing work and growing number of links that we would be able to showcase.
My last question here, and I want to end this on a positive note. Can you tell our listeners a couple of success stories that you're aware of?
Yeah. Thank you. What a great question. So I spoke to the employee whose life was saved due to having Narcan on site. So that's one of my favorites. I also love the story of Kamek, which manufactures boots in the north country of New Hampshire. So basically just think of New Hampshire and like northern New Hampshire. But the plant manager there, Mark Bonta, is one of our biggest champions. And he will share a story of how the culture there really evolved. So when he started with this work, he didn't really know there was another way other than to maybe terminate an employee who was struggling or continued to struggle. And so he will share a story, and he speaks to it even, you know, more powerfully than I can. But there was an employee who was struggling and came to work under the influence. He actually had to drive her home. And a few months later, she tragically lost her life to her alcohol use disorder. So when Recovery Friendly came along, he was so enthusiastic about the program and that there was a way to learn about a different approach. And one of the things I love about Recovery Friendly is that we're able to connect people to peers in this space, because we can provide so much. And at the end of the day, a manufacturer at some point might just want to speak to another manufacturer to say, listen, these are the constraints and the parameters I'm working within. How do you, you know, still do this and be recovery friendly? So in that case, we were able to get them connected to one of our biggest champions, and they actually had been doing this work before the initiative started, and they are Hypertherm Associates, and they're actually a national company. They're actually even global. And so Mark really dove in to understand this work. He actually shut down the factory to do an all-day training for everybody at GenFoot, and that was really incredible to see, and really grew and became a champion. So one of the things he did was institute a return to work agreement. So really looking at those policies, he got into hiring from recovery homes and found that that really was helping him meet some of his staffing shortages, and still actively does that practice to this day. He's had people come forward and, you know, come into his office and ask for help. He's actually called 211 and utilized the state's systems of care and been on the phone and been with that employee to get them support. And just to get a little bit more specific, one of my favorite stories of employee impact is the support of Sean Canisaro, who has become a friend of mine, a dear friend of mine. And so Sean started out at GenFoot and was so encouraged and supported in having that additional chance. So he was able to get his license back. He was able to get his first apartment. He was able to strengthen his relationship with his children. And he was able to move up at GenFoot and became a very trusted employee. Like Mark would talk about, I'd be willing to, you know, throw him the key at the end of the day and say, go ahead and lock up. I think he grew into like a shift leader position. And he also joined GenFoot's they go by CAMIC now, sorry, CAMIC's RFW committee. And he ended up leaving CAMIC, but with full support of Mark, because he wanted to give back in this space even more. And he now owns his own business. He owns a recovery home, and it's called Hope to Freedom Recovery Homes. And they've been able to build additional locations, expand, open up a home for women, in addition to having homes for men. So I just love that, because I think it shows when you believe in somebody, when you let them come as a whole person, when you don't define them by their substance use disorder, but you see, you know, the strengths that that's brought them, and you just give them a chance, the way that they can light up and perform and have that loyalty and want to show you. And in Sean's case, to see all the ways in which he's paying that forward now, I think that that's a really beautiful thing. If people are interested, we do have videos of employer testimonials and employee testimonials, and I'm happy to share those. But yeah, I just love that story so much. So that's one of my favorites, and I'm glad to be able to share that with you all today.
Yeah, that's absolutely wonderful. It's so amazing to hear these stories and know that your work is actually having an impact on people. That is all the time that we have for today. I want to say a very warm thank you to Samantha Lewandowski, Program Director of the New Hampshire Governor's Recovery Friendly Workplace Initiative. Please join us for the next One-on-One with LAPA, where we will discuss another interesting topic. In the meantime, if you would like to learn more about Recovery Ready workplace programs, log on to legislativeanalysis.org. That's legislativeanalysis, one word, .org, and search for Recovery Ready Workplaces, or contact LAPA via email at info@thelapa.org. Thank you.